And this is The World of Work, and I'm your host, Shep Cohen. Our guest today is Dr. Chris Whaley. He's the author of The Masked Saint. Dr. Whaley was a wrestler, and he turned into a preacher man. His job change brought him into a completely different world. He went from professional wrestling and working against 300-pound men to being a Baptist minister working with a faith-based budget. There were so many changes, so many differences. All these questions we're going to answer this afternoon. He's also written a book called The Masked Saint, which documents his transition from wrestling to ministry. And the book was made into an award-winning movie in Canada. Dr. Chris Whaley, thank you for joining us on The World of Work. I'm really looking forward to speaking with you this afternoon.
Jeff, it has been just a great week anticipating being on your show, man. I am so glad to be here, and I thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. And where are we speaking to you from?
Orlando, Florida. Mickey Mouse World.
What got you involved in professional wrestling and wrestling in general? Did you wrestle as in high school or...
When I was in high school, we did not even have wrestling in high school. I grew up watching it as a little boy and just thoroughly loved it. Anytime I could get my dad to take me to the live matches, it was just a home run. And so I grew up watching, you know, all of these guys. And then when I was 24 years old, my wife and I were living in my hometown, and she was teaching at her alma mater. She was a high school math teacher, and I was looking at the Tampa Tribune, and I saw an ad that said, wanted professional wrestlers, and I jumped up out of my seat, and I ran over to my wife, and I said, look at this. She was grading papers. I said, look at this, and she looked at it. And she rolled her eyes and she started grading papers again. And I said, I'm going. And I packed a bag and I drove over to Tampa and I walked into the gym. And there was the guy that I had watched growing up. He was the bad guy. He was the great Malenko. He was in the business. The bad guy was called the heel. He was the baddest heel of them all. And he's the guy that trained me to be a professional wrestler. And it was just one of the greatest days of my life. First time I walked in, and I got hooked the moment that I walked in. I got hooked on professional wrestling.
Wow. Was it just you who was there at the time as trying to get a position, or were there others?
No, there were a lot of guys there who also wanted to be professional wrestler. You got to remember, it was an ad in the paper, so yeah. A lot of guys answered that ad. I actually trained with Malenko's two sons. He had two sons. One was Jody and the other was Dean. Dean Malenko was in the WWF. They called him the man of 1,000 holes. He's now running AEW. And so I trained with him, trained with his brother Jody, and trained with a lot of other guys. Malenko trained, he trained a lot of the guys you see on the WWF. He's the guy that trained them.
What was your shape like at the time? How much did you weigh? How tall are you?
I was 5'10". I weighed 225 pounds, and I had a 33-inch waist. So all the weight was, you know, up in my shoulders. And now I'm 67, and gravity has taken hold and tried to pull it down. So, but no, yeah, I was
that gravity day, works on most of us.
Yeah, in my day. Most of the guys were my size, maybe a little bigger, but by the 80s, that's when, you know, Vince McMahon took over the WWF, and he loves big guys. So the bigger, the better. And but the big guys can't do the moves that the smaller guys like myself could do.
Now, the great Malenko, how long was your training period with him? Was it weeks, months?
No, it was months. I trained for 6 months before I had my first match.
And where was your first match, and how did it turn out?
My first match was in Tampa, Florida, and it was absolutely great. Man, I was so nervous. You know, I had ordered my tights from the organization in Youngstown, Ohio, that provides wrestling attire. I got my boots. I got my trunks. I didn't start off wearing a mask. You know, I just worked under my own name. And I was so nervous when I walked into the arena and got to the dressing room. My heart was pounding, but I was so excited to finally get in the ring and work in front of a crowd. And the first guy that I worked against was a guy called the Grappler, Lynn Denton. He was a grappler, and I worked against him. About 45 minutes into the first match, I broke my nose, so my nose is bleeding. And which is always good for the crowd. You know, they love to see blood.
Yeah.
And, but anyway, we went for about 20 minutes. It was just an unbelievable time in my life. And I got my first match under my belt. And when I walked out, I was ready for my second.
Now, were you a good guy or a bad guy?
Well, I was a good guy. Now, there were a few times where I had the opportunity. When I first went to Texas, I was a bad guy for a couple of shows because nobody knew me in Texas. That was still during the territory time. So I got to be the bad guy, which was a lot of fun because you know, instead of getting beat on, you get to beat on them. So that was kind of cool to do that for a little bit. But no, I was the perennial good guy. Just about 99% of my matches, I was what they call a baby face. The baby faces are the good guys. The heels are the bad guys.
And what was your name in the ring, and how'd you get it?
Okay, I was the Saint, and the way I got that was when I actually got into wrestling while I was looking for my first opportunity to be in ministry. You know, when you're 23 years old, nobody wants a 23-year-old pastor. So the only experience that you can get is as a youth minister. So I was looking for a youth minister job, and I got into wrestling, and I was loving that. But then finally I got that call, and so I started at a county seat church as a youth minister. And my wife got pregnant with our first child, and they don't pay. I think I was making $12,000 a month as a youth minister, which was not a lot of money. And my wife, while she was pregnant, she couldn't work, and so she didn't get paid. I mean, we didn't have those great benefits like they have today with maternity leave. And so I went to the pastor of the church, and I said, you know, I could wrestle a couple of nights a week, and it would really help our family. And he said, absolutely not. We're not going to turn this church into a circus. And so that Saturday when I was home, I was watching wrestling, and I'm watching my buddies on TV. And one of my buddies worked under a hood. That's what they call it when you wear a mask. And then the light bulb came on. I said, that's it. I can wear a mask and nobody will know who I am. And then that way I can wrestle a couple of nights a week and I can earn money. And it's not immoral. There's nothing illegal about it. So I'm going to do it. So that's when I came up with the gimmick or the name, The Saint. So I worked as The Saint. And it was kind of neat, you know, because I would go to church after a match and I'd have bruises all over me, broke my nose or whatever, black eyes. And everybody would say, what happened to you? And I said, I fell down, which was true.
Uh-huh.
I didn't lie. I had a lot of help falling down. So anyway, I was wrestling a couple of nights a week. I was a youth minister and nobody knew but my wife and I.
Now, you were going to school also at the time, or?
Nope. We left for seminary in 1985 and went to Fort Worth, Texas. And so I went to Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. That's where I got my Master of Divinity. And it took 3 years to do that. So the whole 3 years while I was there, I would go to seminary in the daytime, and then I would wrestle at night. And that was a great, great time because the same thing. I would show up in class with a broke nose or with, you know, bruises all over. And my professor would say, I guess you had a rough time wrestling with the Greek last night.
And you did.
Yeah, I did. But it was great, man. I tell you, I loved every minute of it.
What is it about wrestling that you loved?
What is it about wrestling that I love?
Yeah, I mean, you said you loved every minute of it. What is it that you drew you
it
to?
It is the unbelievable ability to get in the ring and work against 300-pound men and to come out a survivor. I mean, that was just awesome. And to when you see fans get on their feet and scream and holler, when you see some of the things that take place in that ring, you say, you know, a human being should not be allowed to do this. And yet, you know, you do it. And it's just phenomenal that you, out of all the people in the world, you have the opportunity to be in that ring and do that. So it was just euphoric. Every time I got into the ring, I was thrilled every time, no matter who I was working against.
How many years did you do it?
I wrestled from 1978 until 1988. So I wrestled for 10 years. And I retired at the age of 34. So I was really at the height of my career. My career had just started to finally start taking off. And that's when I retired to become a pastor. So, you know, even though I'd love to have seen what I could have done, I don't regret it because God called me into the ministry and I was ready to fulfill his calling on my life. And I still got to work, you know, several times after that for some benefits that I did for needy causes. And so I kept in touch with my wrestling buddies and I actually promoted those shows. So I still had my finger in it. I've always stayed in touch with certain wrestling buddies. So even today, one of my closest friends was in wrestling, and we talk every week.
Do you still watch wrestling in person or on TV?
You know, not very often. Wrestling has changed so much. You know, in my day, it was a good guy against a bad guy, and the good guy usually won. Today, it has just become kind of dark. And then some of it is very risque. You know, I wouldn't want my kids watching some of the things that I've seen on there or hearing some of the things that I hear them say. It's just not as much fun as it was whenever I was in wrestling. One of my friends was a guy by the name of Black Jack Mulligan, and Black Jack was in the hospital. I went to visit him, and these two humongous guys were in there. Blackjack was huge also. He was 6'8". Well, these two big guys, and he said, these are my grandboys, and they work for Vince. So they work for Vince McMahon. And one of them was Bray Wyatt, and the other one was Bo Dallas. And so I watched the WWE to see Bo Dallas and Bray Wyatt work because of my friend Blackjack. But that's about the last time that I watched it.
Did you have a lot of training while you were wrestling for those 10 years? By that, I mean, you had to stay in shape. So how did you stay in shape from wrestling, or did you lift weights? Did you run, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, first thing in the morning is you go out and you run because you got to have that wind when you get in the ring, and nothing builds up the wind like running. And so I did that in the morning. And then after I got out of school, I lifted weights. I had my own gym at the house. And so I lifted weights. And then wrestling, you're going to lose a lot of calories when you get in the ring. Not only that, you're going to take a physical beating when you get in the ring. I used to tell people when they'd say, what is it like to be a professional wrestler? I said, every match is the equivalent of being in a car wreck.
Were you ever afraid of an opponent, that the opponent was so big and strong that you wouldn't make it?
Yeah. I walked into an arena in Texas one night. I didn't know who I was working against. And the promoter, I said, who am I working against? And he pointed to this huge black kid that was sitting over lacing up his boots. And at this time, there were a lot of pro football players that were getting into wrestling because they could extend their career regardless of the injuries they had. They could still get in and wrestle. And so he said, that kid is the nose tackle for the San Diego Chargers.
Whoa.
And he was very green. He didn't know what he was doing. And when I got in the ring against him, he had so much power. He threw me around like a rag doll. And one of my biggest fears was breaking my neck because you get thrown a lot of different ways. And that was the most afraid that I ever was in a match was against him because he didn't know what he was doing. And he threw me some very awkward ways, and I landed on my neck. And I was just very thankful to get out of that match that night. And I told the promoter I didn't ever want to work against that kid again. I worked against the Ultimate Warrior. He was a pretty rough guy to work against. Worked against Bruiser Brody. One of the last concussions that I got was against Bruiser Brody from being kicked in the head. So those were guys that you had a certain amount of fear when you got in the ring with them. So thank God not everybody was like that, but you certainly had those times where you were afraid. Yeah.
I mean, you got kicked in the head, you've had concussions. Why'd you continue to do it with those safety hazards?
Shep, I just loved it, man. I could not give it up. I've had over 100 concussions. In 10 years of wrestling, I had over 100 concussions. So I'm hoping one day I can, whenever I pass from this life, I can donate my brain to the organization that is doing all this research for pro football and pro wrestlers, and maybe it'll help them one day. But I had all kinds of, I crushed my ankle. I had 5 knee surgeries, both MCLs, ACLs, dislocated hips, broke pelvis. I broke all my ribs, cracked sternum, both collarbones. I've had both shoulders surgically repaired, neck injuries, back injuries. I broke my nose so many times I can't breathe out of it. I'm deaf in my left ear from getting punched in the left ear so many times. The concussions, the neck injuries, back injuries. I broke all my fingers. It doesn't make any difference. I would still do it all over again.
You would?
Yeah, absolutely.
Are there any restraints in professional wrestling? In other words, they can just go all out, your opponent, and whatever comes up, comes up?
Well, you're supposed to work with your opponent. People, whenever I had the opportunity to speak, you always have Bubba come up to you after you speak and say, "Yeah, wrestling's all fake, ain't it?" And I have to, I name all my injuries. Wrestling is not fake. You can't fake a body slam. You can't fake being thrown over the top rope on the concrete. You just can't fake all of that. But wrestling is predetermined. You know who's going to win. You know who's going to lose. And so, when you meet with the promoter and the promoter says, this is the way the match is going to go. This is the guy that's going to win. This is the guy that's going to lose. But you have to go in there and pull it off. It better not look like it's a work. It better look like it's absolutely real. And that's the way that I tried to do it and the guys that I work with. And most of the guys that you work with are trained. They've been doing it. They know what they're doing. And so it's like being in a concert band. Each instrument has its place in the band. Well, when you get in the ring, you have your place and he has his, and you just pull it off.
What does the ref do? Does the ref do anything?
Oh, yeah. The ref does a lot. I got into a match one time, and I pulled a groin. and that happened about 20 minutes, or excuse me, about 20 seconds into the match. Well, I'm supposed to go 20 minutes, and you did not want to disappoint a promoter. You better do what he says do. And so I tell my opponent, hey, I pull my groin, throw me out of the ring. So he throws me out of the ring. The referee comes out, and I tell him, hey, I pulled a groin. Can you work with me on this? And so the ref, you know, he's the guy that kept that going, because he goes back into the ring and he starts counting you out. You get up, you get back in the ring. The other guy comes, knocks you back down. Then he starts to count all over again. So the referee's helping you until you can gain enough strength to get back in there and finish the match. So, yeah, the refs were, they were very, very important. And, you know, a lot of those referees take bumps too. A lot of them get hit by the wrestlers, get thrown out of the rings, even body slammed, thrown over the top rope. So they have to be, they have to be pretty athletic themselves.
And when you get thrown out of the ring, I mean, what, how do you survive?
You just learn what to do and how to do it. You know, like I've been in 18 man over the top rope battle royals, and the way you get, you know, dismissed from that match is you get thrown over the top rope. And so you just learn how to do it. You know, it's one of those things that you just have to teach yourself to keep from getting killed. You know, you got to learn the way to do it. And I learned very quickly how to do it. So.
And based on your story with the pulled groin early on in one match, I guess you played injured, or you wrestled injured a lot.
Yeah, you know, that's really what bothers me about pro football and pro basketball. And you know, these guys get a little nick and they hold them out of a match. You know, I broke two ribs in Texas one night. I broke two ribs and I worked the next night. Nothing kept me from working. Well, when I tore my ACL, that kept me from working. But, you know, broken ribs, broken fingers, you just tape them up. And you go in there and you do your match. You do it. So I don't have much sympathy for a pro football player that's got a little bit of a strain and refuses to play or doesn't play. That just really irks me when I hear that, because I work with some tremendous injuries. I work with them.
So the men that you worked with, from what you're saying, they were really very good athletes.
Oh, yeah. You better be a good athlete if you get in the ring. You better be a good athlete. Yeah, all of them were great athletes. I've never worked against anyone that was not in great shape to be able to do what we're supposed to do. I mean, you better not get in that ring unless you can do it.
Chris Whaley, was there any match that stands out as being like the pinnacle of your career?
The Undertaker. When it was 1988.
So just when before you retired.
Right. And his name is Mark Calloway, and he was like 23 years old. And so I'm working against him at the beginning of his career, but I knew this guy's going to be a superstar. I mean, he's 6'8", he weighed 315 pounds. He just looked unbelievable. And I was not supposed to work against him that night. As a matter of fact, I had another match. It was on a Friday night, and I'd already worked my match. And when I worked on Friday nights, my wife and my two girls would come. They would watch me wrestle. And as soon as I got through wrestling and took a shower and changed, I'd meet them in the parking lot, and we would go and do our family fun night on Friday night. So on this particular night, I got through wrestling and went back to the dressing room, and I'm taking my boots off, and the promoter came in and said that the guy who was going to work against the Undertaker was not going to make it. And he said, I need somebody to work twice. And I raised my hand and I said, I'll do it, because I knew this kid was going to be a superstar. So I got got the referee to go out and find my wife and girls and tell them not to go to the parking lot. I said, tell them that I'm going to work against. I said, but don't tell them who I'm going to work against, okay? And he smiled and said, okay. So anyway, he came back. He said, I found your wife and girls. They're going to wait. And I said, great. So anyway, I had to get in the ring first because he was the star. And I got into the ring, and I'm looking around trying to find my wife and girls. And I found them. I found them. And then the lights went down, and then this guy walks into that hideous music that they were playing. And when he walked in, I had my girls, I'm looking at them, and my wife, her mouth dropped open. She was like, oh! And then both my girls were crying. And anyway, he gets in the ring. We had a great match. That was the match that I'll always remember, working against The Undertaker. But we went about 20 minutes, and I finished, and I got dressed, and I met my girls, and we had a good time. And we're driving back to Fort Worth. And I looked in the rearview mirror. Both my little girls were asleep. And I looked over at my wife. I said, hey, I said, you know, right before the match started, I noticed that you grabbed your purse and you were frantically going through your purse. I said, what were you doing? And she thought for a moment and she said, oh, I was looking for the checkbook to make sure that you had paid your insurance premium. But I'll never forget that match against The Undertaker. That was awesome.
Did you, how often did you wrestle? In other words, was this every night, once a week, once a month?
Oh, no. I tried to wrestle at least 4 or 5 nights a week because I was still going to school. And some of those nights I really needed to study because a Master's of Divinity, it takes a lot of study because you have a lot of tests. But anytime I had the opportunity to work, I certainly took it, but, it was always at least 4 or 5 times. Now, before that, it was as many as 7 times a week. You wrestle in a different city every night, but that was during the territories. You know, in those days they had 26 territories nationwide, and Florida was a huge territory. And so you could work in a different, you know, one night in Miami, one night in West Palm, one night in Orlando, one night in Tampa, one night in Jacksonville, one night in Tallahassee. You know, you're wrestling in a different city just about every night. You know, when Vince McMahon took over the WWF and he turned it national and international, all of the territories shut down. And so the talent, the big talent from all of those territories drifted to the WWF. And so he had, that's why, you know, he had Turner still had WCW, but he eventually took that over too. So he's the only show in town after a while.
Well, we have to take a break now. We're speaking this afternoon with Chris Whaley, who was a professional wrestler and moved on and changed his career and became a minister. When we come back after our break, we'll talk a little bit about the transition and what it was like to become a minister after spending all this time, as 10 years, that is, as a professional wrestler. This is The World of Work. I'm your host, Shep Cohen, and now this. And we do the work here at WDVR, and we try to do it on The World of Work every week, and we're doing it today with a really interesting guest, Dr. Chris Whaley, who is the author of The Masked Saint. He was a professional wrestler for 10 years and decided that that was enough and went into the ministry. Did you get ready to end your career, or did it just end at that 10th year? In other words, did you plan a going away party or whatever?
No, you know, I did a tour in March of 1988. You wrestle every night. Went into, I think we wrestled in Louisiana, wrestled in Mississippi. And I was working against the Freebirds, against Iceman King Parsons. Had some great matches and just really, really busy. And then after that, I came back, and then I had to finish up my seminary degree. And so there were that was my last semester. And so there were a lot of projects that I had to cover. And so I really didn't get to, you know, go out with a bang. It's like I finished wrestling. I came back and I worked, and I still, you know, wrestled a few times after that. But I was mainly finishing up my seminary degree at that time.
Did you always wrestle with a mask?
Well, I told you at the beginning when I went to the church, that's when I started working with the mask. So that was 1979. So 9 years. 9 years I worked with a mask.
So once you started with the mask, you didn't take it off.
Right, right. I stayed with the same gimmick for 9 years, which was the saint.
Did the congregants in your church know that you were a wrestler, or is it kept a secret still?
When I went to my first church, they. You know, there was some on the committee there that knew about it, but it was not really, it really wasn't advertised that I was being a wrestler or anything like that. I started getting some interviews with newspapers and magazines and things like that. And unfortunately, most of them found out that way when they read in the paper or they read in the magazine that I had, you know, been a wrestler. That's how that happened.
Now, you had this active nightlife, wrestling, so much activity going on. Then you become a minister. Tell us about the transition.
You know, I was in the greatest shape of my life whenever I left seminary to go to my first church. And, you know, I've been used to working with 300-pound men in the ring, and now I'm going to something which I, you know, had never done. I'd never pastored a church. And so I go there, and it was just very stressful. I tell people the most stressful thing I've ever done in my life is be a pastor, because you're dealing with people who are dealing with death. You're walking with people through death. You're dealing with people who are dealing with tragedy in their life, and you're trying to help them. And it was just so stressful, wanting to do everything I possibly could to help the people that, you know, God allowed me to pastor.
Did you ever think of having a ring next door to the church telling someone, and if they don't follow the gospel, you're going to go in there with you?
Well, I didn't use a ring, but that happened. Excuse me. I got to take a drink of water. Excuse me just a second.
Okay, and we're speaking this afternoon with Dr. Chris Whaley, the author of The Masked Saint. He was a professional wrestler and now is a minister. Okay.
I had a young lady who would drop her children off at our children's program, and then she would come around and come into the sanctuary. She was usually the last person in the church, and she was the first person to leave. And I just didn't get to know her. And then one Sunday, she walks in, and she's got sunglasses on, which was a little unusual for inside of a building. She's got sunglasses on. And on this particular day, she waited until everybody left, and she was the last person. She came up to me. She took my hand with both of her hands. She had her head down. And I could see tears coming down her cheeks. And I reached over and I took her glasses and I lifted them, and she had two black eyes. And it just infuriated me. Mm. I mean, any man that would hit a woman is a dirtbag, and especially the mother of his children. And it just made me go irate. And I told her I was going to go see her husband, and she was very nervous. She said, "No, he'll hurt you." And I said, "I'm not worried about it." And so I went to their house and I called him outside, and I said, "You know, I can't believe that you would hit the mother of your children. And I came over here just to see how you would do against somebody who could fight back." And he got real belligerent with me, and then he made the mistake of coming at me. And I had the wonderful time of kicking his butt all over his front yard. And I didn't need a ring, but I would tell you, Shep, that it relieved a lot of stress in my life. And he never hit her again either. And that was the beginning of The Masked Saint right there. That was, you know, the book that I wrote. Each chapter of that book has an actual event that took place in my life. And that was kind of the thing that got The Masked Saint rolling, because then I started having other situations that I handled more as a pro wrestler than as a pastor.
Give me one or two other examples.
Well, one example was I had a young lady that came to the church. She wasn't dressed very nicely. She was dressed kind of risque, and she was a prostitute. And she was just looking for help, trying to get out of that work. And can I just stop here and say, I got to tell you about a little lady that had the greatest influence on my life. When I was a little boy growing up, there was a little black lady by the name of Miss Edna that was just very influential in my life. Some of the greatest lessons that I learned were from her. And she used to quote Edmund Burke that the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. And I took that to heart. I mean, I heard it so many times that I was not going to be one of those guys who stood by while evil triumphed. And so that's why I did what I did. I had to go back there, Shep, and fill that in. But anyway, I just wanted to do everything I could to help this young lady with her life. And she had somebody who was very domineering and pretty much running the show of her life. And I was able to give him an attitude adjustment and to change his thinking on her, able to get her into a place where she could live and help her get a job and change her life. I was on my way to an evangelism conference in South Florida one time, and my girls were really looking forward to it because they were going to go with me and we were going to stay in a hotel. And that was a big event for my girls. And they had to go earlier than I did because I had a funeral to do. And so I had to do this funeral and then leave right after and head to South Florida. And I was really stressed. And I pulled into the service plaza to get something to eat because I was starving. And there were these three hoods that almost knocked me down as I'm going into the building. And that didn't help with my stress. And then when I got inside, those three hoods were bothering people. They were butting in line. They were doing a lot of obnoxious stuff. And so I'm standing in line. They butted. I let them have that one. Then I went over to get my drink and they butted again. And I said, I wish you guys would quit acting like jerks. You know, you're bothering everybody. Why don't you act like human beings? And then all three of them gathered around me. I had one on each side and one in front of me. And I knew that, you know, I wasn't walking away from this. I had to do something. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, Sherlock Holmes, with Robert Downey Jr.
Yes.
When he was about to fight.
Yes.
You know, he kind of went through it in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. And that's exactly, when I saw that movie the first time, I said, that's exactly what I did in certain instances. Huh. Because I had to plan this out in my mind, because there's three of them and one of me. So I said, the guy in front of me, he's going to be talking in a much higher voice. The one on the left is going to have a broke nose from an elbow. And the one on the right is going to be limping for a while because I'm going to take his knee out. And then you had to do it real quick. And so I was able to do it. And I was really I thought I was going to jail on that one because.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Did you ever think about going to jail or being arrested for defending someone but doing bodily harm to Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, after that event, you know, I'm in handcuffs in a back room there at the service plaza, and I've got all this stuff going through my mind.
Oh, they handcuffed you.
Yeah, I'm going to be, you know, on the 6 o'clock news. I might even make national news. And I really don't want to explain this to my wife. And all of a sudden, the state trooper comes in and says, stand up. I stood up. He took the handcuffs off and he said, you're free to go. And I was like, what? And he said, yeah. He said, those three guys are not here to press charges. He said, they probably have some outstanding warrants against them. And the manager is not pressing charges, so you're free to go. And I was like, oh my goodness, how close did I come to getting in a bad situation here? But anyway, you know, sometimes my temper kind of took over, and it shouldn't have, especially with all the lessons that I learned from Miss Edna. But
and who, yep. Who was, just real briefly, who was Miss Edna? I understand she was an influence on you, but who was she? Why was she involved in your life?
Well, when my folks moved to this neighborhood, and I'm, you know, trying to find kids to play with and all, and I'm getting to know, I'm a kid, you know, I'm exploring, and I saw this house that was way down at the end of the street, and so I went down there one day just checking it out, and there she was, you know, working in her garden, and she just became my best friend. I every day after school, I would go down and talk with her, and she was just the most precious, godly woman that I've ever met, and she influenced my life in so many different ways.
Chris Whaley, let's switch gears now. As a minister, how do you deal with and help someone feel better when there's a death in the family?
Well, the greatest thing that you can do is be there. It's called the ministry of presence. If you look at the book of Job, the second chapter, towards the end of the second chapter, when his friends came and Job had lost everything, he lost his family, he lost his wealth, he had physical problems, and his friends saw him from a great distance, and they saw this, and even though these friends really blew it later, they did something right. The Bible says they came and they sat with him, and no one said a word for 7 days. That's called the ministry of presence. Most people won't remember what you said in a time of tragedy, but they will remember that you were there. And so that was my greatest gift, was just being there. I said, I don't have the words that are going to take away your pain, but I just want you to know that I'm here and that I love you and that I'll do anything in the world that I can to help you. And it's just being there, because they won't remember what you said, but they will remember your face and they'll remember that you were there when they needed you.
When you give a sermon, how much preparation goes into it, and why do you pick the topic that you pick on a particular week?
You know, the topics that I pick were usually from the people. You know, I visited the people, and I heard them. I heard their stories. I heard their pain. And all you got to do is look in the Bible, and you can find something that's going to relate to what they were going through. And so I would do that. You know, I would try to do a series of sermons on a particular topic. I love the family. Every year I preached on the family, every year a series of messages to help moms and dads. And you find it in the Bible that's going to relate to what they're going through. It takes about 20 hours of prep to do a message. I mean, I look at the background of it. I took 4 years of Greek, which is what the New Testament was written in. I took 4 years of Hebrew, which is what the Old Testament is written in. And so you look at the passage in the original language that it was written, and it gives you great insight into the Word of God. There's a lot of commentaries, great men and women who have written commentaries on the Bible. You read those. And you just, you know, seek God's help, and you put that message together. But it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of effort.
And how do you motivate your congregants to follow what you're preaching to them?
Well, I had somebody tell me a long time ago, the greatest message you ever preach will be the life that you live. And so I never wanted to be a hypocrite. When I failed, we used to have a daily devotion or a nightly devotion with my girls, my wife and my two daughters. And we would read the Bible and I would talk to them. And then I would pray every night for them. And there were those times that I failed. And when I failed, I told my girls, I said, listen, Daddy's preaching on this subject this Sunday. And I just want you to know that if there's anybody in the building that needs this message, it's me. So I'm not preaching at people. I am preaching to people to help them. And also, it's going to help me be a better person, too, because I'm not perfect. I make a lot of mistakes. And I just wanted you to know that I don't want to be a hypocrite to you. I want you to know when I've failed. And that I'm just a flawed human being like anybody else.
Now, did I hear you right that being a preacher was more difficult than being a professional wrestler?
Yeah. Being a pastor was the most difficult thing that I ever did. All the training in the world doesn't prepare you for some of the things that you face. And the stress, you know, you have a faith-based ministry, a faith-based budget. Your budget is based upon what people give. And people show their displeasure with pastors in their attendance and in their giving. So anytime you saw attendance go down or giving go down, you've usually got a sickness in the church. And it falls back to the pastor. So that, you know, that part was stressful. You never get a vacation. Even when you go on vacation, you're not on vacation. I can't tell you how many times I left on vacation and somebody died and I had to turn around and go back. And that was not fair to my family. But fortunately, they loved me and they supported me and we were able to get through it. But you never get through. Even on vacation, you're thinking about the next message that you preach. You know, Bill Parcells, when he was the coach of the Giants in the year they won the Super Bowl, somebody followed him around and said, that was a great win, wasn't it, coach? And he said, yeah. He said, you're going to enjoy that one. He said, until I get to the office and start working on next week. And that's the way it was in the ministry. You're never finished because Sunday's coming.
But you enjoyed it nonetheless.
Oh, listen, it's what God called me to do. And that's what I did, and I wouldn't change anything.
How about in this your congregation? There's always internal politics.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that, or you just ignore it?
No, you can't ignore it. But that was another thing that made life stressful. You know, some of the people that you have to deal with in church. There's a chapter in my book called The Hypocrite. Which I talked about the biggest hypocrite in the church at that time. And everybody's a hypocrite at some point in time. Everybody, me, you, we're all hypocrites. We do things that we know we shouldn't do. We wouldn't want other people to do. But those kind of people really stress your life out. And I could not overlook it. I mean, I had to deal with it head on. We're not going to let anybody give a bad name to the church. And so it was stressful, Shep, I'll tell you that.
In our closing minutes, let's talk a little bit more about the Masked Saint. Who's your audience?
Who is my audience for the Masked Saint?
Yes.
You know, it's amazing. The book came out in 2016. There's not a week that goes by that I don't get messages on Facebook or emails from people who have read the book or who have seen the movie that was made from the book. It is still reaching people. I have a cop in England that sends me regular messages, and he just told me how much it influenced his life being a cop over in England. I had people in Ireland, people in Romania, people in Hungary. I don't know how this movie and this book has gotten all over the world, but I still have the opportunity to share with people because of The Masked Saint, because of the book and because of the movie. And they always tell me, whether they are people who, and most of them didn't grow up in a church and they were not what you would call Christian folks, that just read the book and loved it and said, you know, I'm glad that there's still people who stand up for what's right. And so I hope it keeps going, Chip. I really do.
Well, based on our conversation this afternoon, I'm sure it will be. In the movie, did you, in the production of the movie, did you play any role? Were you involved at all, or was it just...
I had a couple of cameos at the very end of the movie. At the very end of the movie, there's a cage match, a steel cage match, and I'm one of the audience people. And my one line in the movie is, "You got him, Saint." That's my one line in the movie.
Uh-huh.
And then at the end of the movie, they show pictures from my past, and they give some information about me. And I was there for the filming of the movie. I got to give some advice for certain things. They wanted my counsel on some things, which was absolutely awesome. And the movie is great, you know, for kids, for adults, for everybody. You'll enjoy the movie. You won't have to worry about language. You won't have to worry about, sexual innuendo or those kind of things. Just a great, wholesome, clean movie that's worth watching.
Well, this was a fascinating hour. I really enjoyed it talking with you this afternoon, Chris Whaley. Thank you for being on The World of Work, and continue your good work. And I'll meet you sometime again.
Jeff, buddy, I just really appreciate you wanting me. I've, you know, looked at your website, looked at and listened to some of your interviews, and you are an awesome guy, man. And you keep doing what you're doing, and we'll meet someday. I guarantee it.
Great. Thank you very much.
Until next, God bless you, brother.
Thank you. You too. Until next week, this is The World of Work, and I'm your host, Shep Cohen.